Hello, and welcome to another edition of 20 Minutes In, the film podcast in which we look at the first 20 minutes of films, both great and sometimes terrible, and basically assess them for how well they set up the characters, the themes, etc., etc. If you've been listening up to this point, this is episode 11, so you're probably familiar with the concept. I am, as always, Robert Beams, and I'm joined as ever by Mr. Tom Oliver. Hello, Tom.
Hello, Rob. How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. How's things?
Not too bad. Just been watching stuff, thinking about 20 minutes of movies. Have you watched anything good? Anything? I still haven't got Toy Story hot take. I was been waiting for a while for a Toy Story 4 hot take.
I didn't see Toy Story 4.
Yeah, no, I haven't seen it either, but I thought you might have done.
And, no hot takes forthcoming from me. I don't know if I mentioned it on this podcast before. I think I possibly did, but I have got a dog now. And the thing with that is I've not gone to the cinema really. I think I've been twice since I got the dog.
Right.
Because it's slightly harder to... he's had a wee touch of the separation anxiety, so it's a case of having to... pick my moments. So I only go for the guaranteed gems, Tom, like Detective Pikachu, you know? If it's something really serious.
Can't mess around with
Detective
Pikachu.
Exactly, can't mess around. I've mainly been restricted to the occasional Netflix. Can't even remember. The last film I would have watched was Spider-Man Far From Home, I think. Apart from obviously Prometheus, which we're talking about today. I really enjoyed it. It was good knockabout silly fun, I thought.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah, no, I think that was the last thing I actually managed to sit down and watch in the cinema. And you see, I have no excuse. I have no dog excuse. I work in a cinema. I'm there more than I am at home.
Yeah.
There was literally no reason for me to watch more films. I did manage to see the Spider-Man, which I thought was really good. And the nice to see that they're kind of settling into the post-Endgame world of the MCU.
Yeah.
And I also managed to see In Fabric as well, which is the new Peter Strickland one, which is a kind of horror comedy about a cursed dress, which I really, really liked.
Okay, sounds interesting.
And would recommend to listeners and hosts alike, hosts singular, as there's only one other.
sounds like something I should check out if I can get over the fact I generally don't watch horror movies.
It's really, I wouldn't really class it as a horror movie. It's very, it's kind of like there's a touch of a sort of jam about it. Like it's kind of jam and quite, very Chris Morrissey, not very, I mean, it's about a haunted dress. So at no point does it ever take itself that seriously. And there's something really enjoyable. It's kind of got its own world. Similar in a way to Jam, I guess.
Is Peter Strickland the British director whose first film was a Romanian film?
Yeah.
Yeah, I never saw that film.
I haven't seen his first film, but I've seen Barbarian Sound Studio and I've seen...
I've seen Barbarian Sound Studio.
So I really like his style. Like, I think he's just kind of got his own voice, which I've always got time for. I've actually served him... Back in the halcyon days of the Duke of York, so I actually served him a whiskey, him and Ben Wheatley a whiskey. So that's my sort of 15 minutes.
I misheard you very slightly and heard served with him, so I thought you meant like in the armed forces.
That would have been amazing.
That would have been a story.
Yeah. Oh, God. There's a spoof film.
Misunderstandings.
A platoon made up solely of slightly indie... up-and-coming filmmakers.
So, as you may have heard just in the middle of all of that nonsense, I mentioned that we were talking about the film Prometheus today, which, as I say, I realised doesn't really need to be introduced that way because people, if you've downloaded it, you probably saw that in the title of the episode.
Yeah.
But we're looking at the film Prometheus.
It's in keeping with the form of podcast.
Isn't it? It's in keeping with the format. Maybe you've just got them running through.
Yeah,
you
who's
need,
to say,
you're just
you know?
Listening in the background, you know, you're doing the washing up, but you're painting or something, you know, you're doing something else.
I'd love to think that people have our podcast in as background noise sounds kind of wrong, but
it's
like essentially, you know, it's sort of like a nice wallpaper to whatever they're doing. Like if people cook to our podcast, that would be great.
Yeah, maybe you're cooking to this podcast. In which case, this is for you, Dave.
Yeah.
If you're cooking to this and your name is Dave, yeah, please get in touch. So we're doing Prometheus, as you say. This is an interesting one because we've talked about it before on this podcast, that there are films out there which have a shaky beginning or even a bad beginning and end up being good films. That was kind of when we talked about the Avengers. I more or less ended up on that side of the fence with it, where it's a film I really like, but the first 20 minutes are arguably its least good 20 minutes. Yeah. And you suggested Prometheus as a really good example, actually, of the reverse. Not that the first 20 minutes are a masterpiece, but that it's one of those films where the setup and at least the filmmaking technique and everything in the first 20 minutes, you've not yet decided, oh my God, Ridley shit the bed, this is awful. You're kind of with it, right?
Yeah, very much so. I watched it. It's just kind of, sometimes I sort of scroll through, a collection looking for a watch, and whatever mood I'm in could be completely, I mean, it's completely arbitrary, really. It just happened to pop up and I thought I'd give it a look in. Just because, I remember very distinctly it coming out and being just the strongest contender in my mind for the sort of beginnings of, very divided opinions on it. Like, for the most part, I think people felt that it was disappointing. I have a few friends who really go to bat for it in quite convincing ways, not just, oh, I like it because it's alien and it's in space, but like just have a really good case for it. I was very let down, as I imagine most people were. Like, it's obviously, I'll restrict myself as much as possible before we get into it, but it just didn't pan out the way I'd imagine. There's so much potential for some really interesting kind of old school sci-fi concepts, you know. And I think in essence that's what I really feel in those first 20 minutes, is that we're leading into something really exciting that doesn't pan out. Can you remember the first time you saw it in your
I saw it at midnight showing for some reason, which is strange.
So did I, actually, yeah.
Oh yeah, which is strange looking back on it, just because the only films I've ever seen at midnight have been things like a Star Wars or like one of the Marvel tentpole movies or something like that. Midnight launches tend to be more for things like that than they tend to be for the kind of whatever it is, the fifth sequel in the Alien franchise that no one particularly cared about when it came out, you know. So I kind of, in my mind, I'm sort of like, really, did I see it at midnight? And I'm fairly sure I did. Interesting that you did as well. We were both sort of right there for it.
I remember it, I was at the Odeon, I was working at the Odeon when it came out, and it, there was this real sense of anticipation that it was it kind of billed itself as not an Alien sequel, not a prequel, it's kind of its own franchise with a relationship to the Alien movies. Like, essentially it's set in the same world, but it's not quite a spin-off. It's not right to call it a spin-off, but it was Ridley Scott and he was returning to that world, and obviously it felt like part of the Alien franchise, which I suppose it is. So there was a sense, it's like we're getting another Alien movie in the way that you would anticipate a Marvel or a Star Wars, is we're getting one of those and there needs to be a big release. So that, it kind of made sense at the time. Obviously, in hindsight, it just doesn't feel quite right. Like, you wouldn't have done it for Alien Covenant, and I don't think anyone did.
Yeah.
Even though that's probably more directly relative to the franchise.
Well, yeah. I think something strange about it is I saw this film twice, once on this midnight, and then I think I probably gave it another chance when it came out on Blu-ray or whatever, and wasn't particularly fond of it. But what was really interesting this time watching it was I'd completely forgotten Charlize Theron was in this movie.
Yeah, like, so did
when
I.
When the credits came up, I was like, what? Who does she play? I just couldn't remember at all.
Yeah. I also completely forgot that Guy Pearce is in it playing like a 90-year-old man for about, he's in later in that. He's in quite a bit of the film, I guess.
He's in the sequel as well, isn't he? Alien, whatever the bollocks. You just mentioned it.
Alien Covenant.
Alien Covenant. He's in that one a bit as well.
Is he? Oh, I don't.
Yeah,
do
you not see Alien Covenant?
I watched like half of it and lost patience with
it. Oh, I remember him being in that more than he's in Prometheus.
Right, okay. Yeah. I might watch that again, actually, just out of kind of morbid curiosity. So this film, I remember it was just so super hyped and such a letdown. Like it just couldn't deliver on anything that it had going for it, which is watching the first 20 minutes is a real shame because, like I was saying, there's so much promise in those first 20 minutes.
The other thing is I remember not liking it when it came out, finding it in places quite boring, in places preposterous, just things that were kind of overdone in it and whatever. We'll get to some of that stuff maybe if it's in the first 20 minutes. But what I didn't remember that I was really surprised by is that Noomi Rapace is doing a kind of English accent and that it's really weird.
Yeah.
I didn't remember that at all. Like, yeah. It's strange because she's, I think the first, I couldn't really hear her dialogue too well during the first bit on Isle of Skye to dictate whether there was an accent or not.
Yeah.
And then there's a bit where there's like a flashback to her when she was a child, and it's very clearly like, you know, when they do flashbacks to like young Lara Croft, and she's always this like really plummy girl going, oh, but daddy, can we go on the exhibition? No, Lara, you know, it's one of those sort of flashbacks. Yeah. And then I thought, oh, shit, is she English in it then? And then she turns up just sounding, you know, kind of slightly like she's trying to do the voice, but also a bit Swedish.
Yeah.
It's a bit weird because it's this fantasy sci-fi space nonsense, right? She doesn't have to be English, right? Like, why does she have to be Dr. Elizabeth Shaw? Couldn't they just hire Noomi Rapace and then just say she's Swedish?
Dr. Bjorkson or something
Like, I just really don't... It seems so unnecessary to go, and by the way, you need to do an English accent. I just don't get why that's necessary for this movie.
Well, there is, I think, in the whole thing, there is just a plethora of weird accents, of which I'll get onto, one of which is very distinctly in the first 20 minutes.
Yeah, Idris Elba's American accent is possibly the other one you're referring to, right?
Yeah. Although, I mean, he's obviously had his sort of tenure in The Wire to kind of refine it.
But this is a very
a
different American accent, though, he's doing here.
I suppose it is, yeah.
It's because to me, I found that one a bit unconvincing. And then... what was the other one you were referring to then? The other weird choice?
So, well, the weird one is it's a very small cameo from just Patrick Wilson, just out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Patrick Wilson pops
up. Yeah, and he's British, isn't he?
Well, is he though? Because like I really couldn't fish it out. Like it's very Patrick Wilson, his voice, but every other word drops into a kind of heavy British thing, and obviously he literally is in the film for less than 2 minutes in a sort of dream flashback with Noomi Rapace, her central character. And obviously, like you're saying, she's plummy British little girl. And so clearly her dad is supposed to be British, like a kind of British, you know, national in sort of other parts of the world. And but I couldn't detect a strong accent, and I kind of thought, you're in it for 2 minutes, mate, just like, these are the lines, you don't have to carry the whole film with the accent, just get them down.
But this
just
is
get the accent down, and I couldn't place it.
This is the wild thing about it for me though, is that obviously, you know, there are loads of films where British people play Americans and vice versa and whatever, so it seems kind of funny to pick on it here. But when there are so many available British actors, American actors, why does Idris Elba need to be American? Why does Noomi Rapace need to be British? You know, I just don't. Why does Patrick Wilson need to come in and be British potentially? Like, it's very strange. I mean, Charlize Theron, fine, because she always does an American accent, even though she's South African, and her American accent just sounds perfect. And isn't distracting at all. So she can turn up and be American. I mean, she could have very easily been a South African space captain. This is the thing I don't understand, is they make such a thing of the spaceship crew being this kind of bunch of misfits from all around different countries and places. I don't understand why any of them necessarily had to be voices of anything in particular.
Yeah.
Right? They could have just been. But putting that to one side, let's say, like, for whatever reason, a thematic reason or something, Charlize Theron's character had to be American. At least her American accent is, at least to my ear, perfect. You know what I mean? Whereas
definitely.
Idris Elba's one stands out a bit. Noomi Rapace's one's a bit weird. I just don't really understand the casting, is what I'm saying.
It kind of occurs to me now that Idris Elba's American accent doesn't bother me nearly as much as Rafe Spall's. Like, when Rafe Spall turns up and he does that kind of, like, slightly, I guess, Southern American, it's like, hi there, I'm a biologist, and you're just like, shut up, just stop it. Like, that one, I think, for me, probably tops.
That is a weird one as well.
Doesn't work
at
all.
That's a weird one as well. It is quite strange. I think one thing that we'll come on to in talking about this first 20 minutes is it does a fairly good job, this first 20 minutes, of establishing not necessarily all the characters. I think the main characters, it establishes enough about them, but it gives little moments to all the key background alien fodder characters,
yeah,
so that we kind of have an idea of what archetype they are. All that gets set up quite neatly, but let's do what we usually do and sort of run through
the breakdown.
The film starts with these very 2001 A Space Odyssey adjacent sort of shots of just the camera sort of flying over landscapes, right?
Yeah,
which felt to me like a very 2001 way to start.
Yeah, it's like it's literally like prehistoric Earth. It's like those shots at the beginning of 2001 where you see, I can't remember where it is in 2001, but it's like that, you know, in 2001, before you see the ape characters, it's just shots of landscapes.
So but I'm thinking kind of more in that. The final bit of the film when he's kind of, the camera's just flying over all these landscapes, you know, just for a long time.
Oh, the
time.
Kind of,
with all the color, the
psychedelic type.
Yeah,
things.
Obviously it doesn't have the filters on it, but it's those same sort of shots of the camera just flying over lakes and mountains
and all this
kind of stuff. And you don't really know it's Earth at this point because it's such an alien-looking landscape.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's only when you see sort of maybe 5 minutes in that Noomi Rapace and her little team are on the Isle of Skye, comes up and says they're in Scotland, that you think, oh, wow, because I just assumed watching it when I started it up, I thought, okay, so this is a team on some alien world, because I'd forgotten like where they were and what they were doing. So they could easily have been doing some kind of archaeological dig on some random ass planet, you know what I mean? But the fact that it turns out to be Scotland, turns out to be Earth, I think really cool, because it it gives this impression that ties into a lot of the rest of the movie, which is also the idea that, you know, we're aliens, the Earth is a random planet in space.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I just thought that was kind of interesting. Maybe it was obvious to you that it was Earth like at the beginning and all that, but to me it just, without any context, it, you know, it just looked like a weird sort of place full of rocks and big waterfalls, you know.
Yeah, it seems to be the de facto choice with any sci-fi film. If you want to film a physical looking alien planet, just film it in Iceland, because they have those kind of like volcanic black areas of ground which just don't look like Earth, basically.
Like,
it's a very specific region of the world, which is beautiful, but doesn't have Earth characteristics. It's not very green. Like, it's not covered in snow. It's not like a desert. It's just this strange alien-looking landscape.
You get these shots of what turns out, I guess, to be the Earth. You see this cloaked, hooded figure walking towards the edge of this waterfall. A big alien spaceship thing takes off and flies away. And he drinks some weird shit, and he takes off his robe, and he's like a big white, almost like a marble statue or something, isn't he?
Yeah.
He looked like a kind of Michelangelo or something like that.
Which I think, again, is another really neat touch, because, soon after, like, the next scene, effectively, it starts talking about these characters as being, in sort of prehistorical, or, like, very early cultures, they're sort of worshipped in the same way, like, the idea that, I think I actually read this, maybe in like an IMDb trivia, that they chose to characterize them that way because they look like marble statues, and that early civilizations would see these and choose to sculpt them out of marble. And I thought that was a nice little touch to give them some kind of, you know, they're not sort of like green gribblies with like tentacles and stuff. It's these kind of, giant man humanoid type things. And has that sort of, like you say, look like marble sculptures.
So this alien creature takes a drink of this weird stuff, and then its skin starts like decaying and mutating on a kind of molecular level. And this was the first red flag for me. The bit where, but this might just be a pet peeve, this might not actually be fair, you tell me.
Okay.
I've got a real problem with when cameras do ridiculous CGI moves, like going into, like Danny Boyle does this all the fucking time.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
Like in 48 hours or whatever the fuck it's called. That, which, what's that
128
one called?
Hours?
128 hours, yeah. 48 yeah. hours would probably be all right.
Yeah.
That's not that bad. I'll see you in a couple of days.
It's just a 15-minute movie.
Yeah, 128 hours. There's all those bits where the camera's like in outer space, and then it goes from outer space into a straw and then into the bloodstream or whatever. And I find all that stuff really distracting and really pointless. And it seems to be technique and style for its own sake, and it doesn't need to actually say anything or offer anything. And so when the camera goes through the guy's skin, and then it's like in a CG sort of skin canyon, and then it goes in and sees DNA strands going around, to me, I could live without that bit personally, because everything outside of that looked really cool personally.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I'm too close-minded on the kind of the Boyle techniques being employed.
No, I mean, Danny Boyle's use of that is particularly aggressive. Like, I've only watched the trailer for Yesterday, and it's about the Beatles and a guy forgetting the Beatles. And there was one shot which is like outer space of the Earth having an entire power cut. And I was like, ah, yes, I'm in a Danny Boyle film. It doesn't matter if it's set in Norfolk. He'll find a way to film a shot from outer space.
But even Fincher doesn't really get away with it. Like, Panic Room's full of that stuff, isn't
yeah,
it?
Like just, through the coffee just, cup handle and
yeah,
stuff like
just,
that.
Yeah, just stuff just, like that. The,
no, I do
I
agree
can live without it.
I felt like in this case, I agree on that principle, but it didn't strike me as too kind of sticking out, just because it's starting the film. It's essentially a prologue thing, and it's starting the film without any dialogue. And so you're getting a kind of exposition episode, if you like, and just to sort of get a sense that this is, you know, destroying him on a molecular level. It didn't bother me too much, but I definitely could have, you know, I would have got it without it in there. You know, I would have got what's going on.
I think, because I did think that. I thought, well, they're trying to show, not tell here. So maybe you need to see him break down on this molecular level like that.
Yeah.
But then what happens is he crumbles away and he falls down this waterfall into the water. And that bit looks really cool. Like, I love this idea. I love this idea that, these people, I don't know why they can't just send their equivalent of a pig to do this with, why they have to send one of their guys. But for whatever reason, they've got to send one of their guys in. And I love the idea that they're almost like a kind of a seed pod man, you know, has to go and kind of spark life. They just throw this man down on a planet, and then he kind of crumbles into a waterfall, you know, spreads his, pollinates the world with life. But the thing that's really cool there is he kind of crumples into the water. Then as he hits the water, you get the camera going underwater and you see him kind of break into bits. And then there's a really cool looking bit where the molecular DNA strand type stuff starts coming out of him and then kind of reforming and stuff in the water and spreading around. And I think you could have kept that bit because it looks really good, and it kind of seems to come out of his body and not had to go zooming into his veins or whatever, which I just but this is really just me particularly not liking that type of thing, rather than it being objectively bad, right? But it goes to, I don't know if Aliens and Alien Resurrection and stuff all did this, I honestly can't remember, but Prometheus goes back to the original title for Alien, right? Where it it comes in as a couple of lines and then kind of gradually comes in, and Prometheus pops up, and then we pop up on Noomi Rapace and the guy that she's with, who kind of looks like Budget Tom Hardy. I was going to say exactly that. I've written down Budget Tom Hardy in my notes.
He is, though. There's no other way.
I have no idea who that guy is. And I thought I could look it up and seem a bit more like I do my research, or I could just revel in the fact I have no fucking idea who that guy is. The way I'm
trying to go. Budget Tom Hardy is a good way forward.
Yeah. There's a kind of, I'm not suggesting this is a reference or anything, but it reminded me very much of Jurassic Park, the first shot of Noomi Rapace. Like, the pick through the kind of rocks and the kind of torchlight and things coming through.
Yeah.
Like when the blood-sucking lawyer goes down into the dig.
Yeah,
kind of like
absolutely.
That.
And there are a couple of very Spielbergian feeling moments, at least in the first 20 minutes. That's definitely one of them, I think.
I think whenever you see those sort of torches with the visible beams. I always think of Jurassic Park or the X-Files, one or the other.
One thing I actually want to mention quickly, sorry to cut you off in the middle of your point, but something I think is really, really important to giving the sort of, like, elevating the film as it is right now is the score. I think the score, like, most of the way through, but definitely in these initial moments, is really fantastic. Like, it doesn't sort of settle on a kind of Hans Zimmery, like, string ostinatos. Like, there's a very stock score sound, which has become commonplace in kind of sci-fi movie making. Like, I was watching the 2014 Godzilla the other day, which I'd never seen and wasn't very good. But it had, it's really just very stock score, which just bothered me the whole way through. And I think this score has, like, a very distinctly Star Trek sounding kind of progression to it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's, there's something, it's not sort of saying, it's not signposting events in a story. It's giving this sort of overview of, like, you know, the world of science fiction discovery, and kind of takes the film from just a dumb space action movie to kind of trying to harken back to, like, the idea of 50s sci-fi. Like, we're going to explore space. Like, there's a very 50s sci-fi score influence in the music, and I think that's really plays a strong part in the film. But that was kind of a little aside, but I did think it was important.
I think it's good. I think I didn't really notice it myself, which is stupid, because I know often people say about scores, not noticing it is almost a good thing because you're supposed to just kind of be involved in the movie. But obviously the whole point of what we're doing is to try and notice these things. And I kind of, it just almost completely slipped my notice. So I need to go back probably and give that more of a listen. But definitely the opening 20 minutes has a very consistently kind of captivating atmosphere, which the score's going to have a huge kind of roll in. Something quite good, I think, in this scene with Noomi Rapace and the Tom Hardy looking bloke is the fact that you get a lot of very fast information about who their characters are and what journey they're on with. They set up the fact they're in some kind of romantic relationship by having them hold hands and by having him shine the light on her and her being, no, we need to look at the thing on the wall, kind of like, it's like he can't take her, you know, he can't take his eyes off her or whatever. So you kind of set up that they've got this relationship without explicitly having someone say, look, we've been dating for 7 months, you know, whatever. You know what I mean? You just see that they're romantically involved while they're talking about other shit. The other shit they're talking about is this archaeological stuff they're doing, so you understand this is their role, this is what these guys do. And then there's one of the main themes of the movie and running threads for Noomi Rapace's character, which is where she says, I thought we were never going to find them, she says at the end of that scene. And I didn't think too much of it the first time I watched this 20 minutes through this morning. But then when you get the bit later on where she has the line, I really hate, but I really hate stuff where, especially where scientists talk about faith and belief, like it, but I kind of have to put that aside as well, because I kind of feel that's what this movie is explicitly about, so that's kind of just not engaging with the film on its own terms. But anyway, she has a line a little bit later on, which we'll come to, about how she's driven by belief to come and find these aliens, and the fact that she says I thought we're never going to find them is an interesting choice of words, because these aren't discoveries she's making as a scientist. These aren't things where she's just going out with an open mind and encountering what she encounters. She specifically is looking for these guys. She's already decided that these alien gods, for want of a better word, exist. She believes in them and wants to meet them, and that's what she's driven by. So I think it's kind of clever the way they allude to that then, or set that up. We cut to the spaceship. it's obviously a couple of years down the line, or that doesn't. Yeah. I don't think it pops up with a date or anything, but it's a couple of years down the line, and Fassbender Bot's walking around.
Yeah.
And he is going around spending his time on there. It's normally in the Alien movies, there's a robot, but you don't know who's the robot till they get injured or something. It's fairly clear straight away this is a robot, right? It's more.
Yeah.
He's very wooden in everything he does.
Maybe this is my sort of internal knowledge of like the Alien franchise and knowing about how they've been produced. But obviously, a lot of the later sequels, so things like Alien 3 and Resurrection, because they were such hot properties, went through like extensive rewrites and different versions. And sort of things like this scene, which is just, you have the whole crew in hypersleep except for the android who's just wandering around the ship doing things. They've popped up in sort of early drafts of ideas for scripts and were always like sort of strong contenders and kind of I really like that idea. It's a kind of simple concept, is that you just have this whole crew in hypersleep and then a ship out there in space in the middle of nowhere, and obviously the robot just doesn't have to sleep, so he just sort of, you see a sequence of him like biding his time. And that's another thing I think sticks to the strengths of where this film could go, is it's starting to explore more interesting ideas and isn't initially relying on the kind of franchise cachet of like things, and at least not directly. It's not desperately trying to like pin epic moments on a threadbare plot, at least not initially. It's like taking its time in a kind of epic mega budget context. It's kind of focusing in on these people and setting up these people and their relevance to the themes of the story.
It's a really neat thing for his character as well, this character David that Fassbender plays in this film and also in the sequel they made, is basically the fact that they show him riding around on a bike while perfectly kind of spinning a basketball and throwing them in a hoop. It sets up two ideas at once there, these kind of themes that run through the film, which is, on one hand, is he better than us? You know, have we created something better than us that will replace us? You know, because Charlize Theron's character, which we'll come to in a bit, she definitely seems kind of threatened by David. And she makes a great kind of deal of ordering him around and getting him to make her drinks and things like that, treating him as a, give me a towel, give me a drink, you know. And when you get Guy Pearce, who we'll talk about again in a bit, when he turns up on the video that he's recorded, he talks about how David's the closest thing to him, to a son, and you get a cut to a reaction from Charlize Theron looking a bit kind of rolling her eyes at that or whatever, almost jealous or something about it. So on one hand, it's like, have we accidentally made something here that's better, that's kind of going to replace us, is the future of humans? But on the other hand, there's this ongoing concept of, does David have a soul? You know, is David a real person? And I think you see that in how everything he does is just too perfect. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like when he's dunking those basketballs effortlessly and there's no joy in it and there's no kind of... I don't know. There's no doubt he's going to get it wrong. Like, it's almost impossible for him to get it wrong. And it goes in perfectly. Every time he does anything, it kind of goes by exactly perfectly. Spinning the ball on his finger is kind of something that seems to take him really no effort at all. It seems like a mathematical calculation rather than a skill or a thing he's had to really practice. You know what I mean? And so you kind of get this idea, is this guy really a person? Or I think you get a lot wrapped up potentially in seeing the way he interacts.
I think one of the frustrating things about the film is that what is going on in this scene, which I think is really fantastic, and it's never really followed up on, is that there is this whole question of he's a robot, but they don't do the kind of stock robot character thing of him just going around and like reading off, like doing things that only robots can do, in that sense that he's just a they don't make him just a servant for the human characters. Like, they spend this time sort of selecting things for him that give him a certain personality. So it's like, why is he going around doing basketball? Out of all the things a robot could do perfectly in the way that he does that, I think it's interesting that you see him carrying that ball around with him on the ship and sort of bouncing it around, and then later you see him dyeing his hair, like he's got dye in his hair, so that he, and he's watching Lawrence of Arabia, and he's sort of modelling himself after
Peter O'Toole.
And,
yeah,
you know, that kind of investment in him is, in a way, you know, a lot of the film is populated by very stock characters giving sort of expository lines and filling certain roles, and he is, in essence, one of the more fleshed out kind of personalities in the film, but that obviously it never really comes to anything. Like later on in the film, like nothing ever really becomes of it, except there's one scene when he's learning sort of ancient historic languages, and then he uses that information later on in the film, and that's kind of the only real setup payoff.
That's kind of clever as well, because by showing him doing lots of things and just making learning the languages one of them, it allows that to kind of be snuck in there. Whereas if it just showed him doing that, you go, oh, well, that comes up later then. But because he's also riding a bike and doing basketball, you kind of it all gets lost in the shuffle, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of clever as well.
It actually looks like he's doing that for real. Like surely he can't be, unless he's amazing. Michael Fassbender is amazing at spinning basketballs, but it looks like he's doing it. It's not an effect, but it must be. I mean, that's like, I don't know, only certain. I mean, it must be said that for my money, at least, his performance in this film, and I don't think this is particularly controversial, it is like the best performance in the film. Like he is like potentially one of the, if not the strongest sort of, like acting performances in the film. Like I think he's one of the highlights of the whole thing.
Yeah, he is. It's one of those things though, like Captain Jack Sparrow syndrome, though, where in the sequel, because he was clearly the best thing for the first one, the sequel's pretty much all about him and goes into much more depth, sort of trying to explore and explain him and his motivations, which, you know, I think is because they realised, oh, hey, we don't really want to keep anything else we did in Prometheus, but let's salvage this one thing that was good.
He was good.
Yeah.
Get him back.
Get him back. Get Benderbot back in. So... here's the thing. Here is where I'm going down. Sort of, I don't want to be cinema sins or something here. But here's where I'm going down a slightly nitpicky, sort of area here. So he goes and touches Noomi Rapace's like pod, and he's got some sort of weird visor on, and that's when we get the flashback, presumably, that he's watching. It's shot through this kind of weird orangey filter, and he watches, presumably, this kind of memory of her as a little girl talking to the Patrick Wilson dad and having this conversation about the nature of belief and is there a heaven and a hell in, you know, her dead mum, is she in paradise? And it ends with Patrick Wilson's character saying, well, what do you believe? And that's kind of obviously a big thread in her life and for her character. Her character actually wears a crucifix as well, doesn't she? So she's clearly supposed to be the very religious. She's both the scientist and the religious character, which is an unusual mix in a film. Yeah. Here's my nitpick. Why is, if we're watching her memories, and I don't know how he's got the facility to do that, but hey, it's the future, it's science fiction, whatever the fuck, right? If he's watching her memories, why are they shot like shot reverse shot? Like, why are they shot like a film? Like, I really don't understand why they're not like being John Malkovich through her eyes or something, you know what I mean? I'd find that really strange, and that's the sort of thing that takes me out of it.
Yeah, no, I'll go for that. I mean, you don't dream in shot reverse shot, although I wish I did. I wish I could, like, perfectly shot list my dreams and just get, you know, instead of the awkward. but yeah, no, it doesn't really make sense. But I don't know, is that one of those things that you... I mean, I'm assuming that you've mentioned it because it really stuck out to you.
I don't remember it really bothering me like the first time I saw the movie, so it was me kind of more of a close read on it, but I was watching it slightly confused, more because as well it makes it slightly less clear what's going on. Like, if Fassbender was watching this thing from the perspective of Noomi Rapace's little girl, you'd kind of have a much clearer idea that he's watching her sort of, I don't know, her memories or her thoughts about this encounter. But when it's clearly just shot like a movie, it's like, here's one that always bothers me. When characters in, usually on TV this happens, because on TV I guess budgets are tighter, but it happens in a lot of movies as well, even movies by good filmmakers, when they watch CCTV footage of something or a secret videotape somebody made of something, and it's the same shot that we saw when it happened.
Yes,
no, like,
that
were we watching it from that,
that really
camera then? You know, I really hate that. And it, to me, this is the kind of adjacent thing to that. Kind of like, this doesn't seem to be being shot. It basically looks like, in terms of how it's shot, like they shot it as a standard flashback. And then during the editing process, this was the best place to put it. You know what I mean?
Because
it doesn't seem like it's been shot purposefully to be this weird memory thing. It seems to be like just a standard scene of a film that now has a kind of orangey filter over the top of it.
Yeah, definitely.
I just think it could have probably been done in a slightly better way to make it seem like he was... Like, if for example, he's watching her dreaming and this is what she's dreaming about, because it doesn't explain, is it memory, is it a dream, is it just he's looking through her thought patterns, then you could go another way with it, and you don't have to have it from her eyes, but you could have it be a bit more weird and scattershot because it's maybe... he's watching kind of somebody's thought process, you know? But it doesn't do that. It just does a very standard, very trite flashback that literally is like the flashbacks you get every time they make a Tomb Raider movie.
It's really got
an orange filter on it.
That is something that really bothers me, is when you see news clip, like in a disaster film, and they show the news in the background and it's this perfectly lit, perfectly graded. It's just a shot taken from the film earlier.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really bad. Yeah, I dislike that. I can't say it really bothered me, but I know there is a better way to do that, that it is still not a distracting kind of approach to that type of idea, that is also like it's the same thing, but it's not done in a way that's like a professional shot, reverse shot of a memory or a dream. I can't say it stuck out massively, but I do think it is, you know, there is a better way of doing it. That's definitely true, I guess.
Even just a kind of static camera watching the two people, you could imagine that's got something to do with a technology they use to kind of record memories, or I don't know. It just seems very odd the way it's done. It, like I say, it looks kind of quite just like a scene in the film with an orange filter on it. So he watches this flashback thing or whatever it is. And then he wakes up the crew. He gets an announcement saying, oh, you've arrived at your destination. I guess one thing I will say about him watching the flashback that I've only just considered is that as the film goes on, it becomes clearer and clearer that David's potentially quite creepy and quite threatening. And the fact that he's going around presumably just watching intimate moments of the crew is the first tip to that, right? Like, it's the first suggestion that, why is this robot? Because when you first see it in this context, maybe he's just bored, maybe he's just learning about them, maybe he's just checking up on them, you know, or something. But within the context of what you know about him from the rest of the film, it plays into this idea that he's a kind of sociopath robot and he's going around being weird. But anyway, there's an announcement on the ship. It says that they've arrived at their destination. So he does the whole waking the crew from cryosleep thing. When he's talking to the computer, I may be reading too much into this, I fully admit, but when he's talking to the computer sounds very HAL-ish, obviously, and he's called David, which I'm guessing is more named after like Michelangelo's David and religious sort of connotation.
Yeah.
But the fact that there's a HAL computer talking to a Dave, and the Dave is also a robot, is... interesting to me. It's kind of like funny inversion of the 2001 thing. It's like HAL and Robo Dave are both having the conversation.
There's neat bits of intertextuality throughout the film. Like, obviously, I mentioned it before, but Lawrence of Arabia, you see him watching it, but there are references to lines in that. And there's not direct, like, references, but there's things like, there's a line later on, I think it's Big Things Have Small Beginnings, which is from Lawrence of Arabia. And it's not just like he says it and then it goes, oh, yeah, it's from the film I watched, Lawrence of Arabia. That was also about going into foreign lands and you know, it doesn't do that. It's just, it sort of slips those lines in. And that, I think, is indicative of, at least initially, smart kind of writing, like layering these things in to kind of boost the thematic resonance, I guess.
Yeah. So we get introduced to Captain Theron. As is tradition for me, I rarely know the characters' names in films.
That's perfect. I mean, these are all good.
We get introduced to Captain Theron. She's working out. We get established right away that she's a hard ass, and she's a take charge.
She woke herself
kind of,
up from
cryosleep. She woke herself up. She doesn't need a robot to wake her up from cryosleep. Yeah. And she immediately gives him orders and stuff, and tells him what to do, and does sort of treat him rather more like a tool or something than like a person. Yeah. Then we go round the ship a little bit. We meet some of the other crew who've woken up. Idris Elba is the ship's kind of pilot, isn't he? Or the guy in charge of the bridge, I guess. And we meet these other various characters. You've already mentioned the Rafe Spall one, who's the biologist.
Yeah.
I can't remember the name of the actor who's sitting opposite him in that scene.
Sean Harris?
Sean Harris. He plays the kind of the creepy,
weird, surly
guy who's probably, I guess you're supposed to think at this point he's going to be trouble. You know, he's like the criminal on the exhibition or something.
This is where all that clever character stuff starts to really fall apart, because it's literally just like they've written an interaction where some plucky kind of biologist, Rafe Spall, he's like, they're just like, oh, we'll have him going around the crew, getting to know people like a kid on his first day of school. And then you have surly Sean Harris just sitting there being like, look, nothing funny, but just fuck off, will you? And it's like, it's just really weak. Kind of scene.
Yeah, I mean, he's especially because he rebuffs him by saying, "I'm just here to make money." It's like that you're not going to learn anyone's names during this work assignment. Then,
I won't remember anyone's names.
I just go to work to make money. I don't sit at my desk and say, "Like, no offense, I'm just here to make money."
It just is. Yeah, this is like it's just really dumb.
But I will say, in it to its credit, that even if that's not a particularly deep characterization, what the film very neatly does with a lot of the kind of side characters like that is it does just establish broad archetypes for them. You get a broad sense of who the flight crew are. You get a broad sense of there's this biologist on the exhibition. There's this potentially wild card guy here. You kind of get introduced to them. They don't really get fleshed out, but then they don't really need to be because they're kind of just bodies in the room at this point.
Yeah.
This leads to a briefing scene where everyone's in some dingy-looking cargo hangar, and then they watch a kind of ridiculous hologram production of old Guy Pearce. Is he Weyland? Peter Weyland, isn't he?
He's
and he's
Peter
like
Weyland.
The from the Weyland-Yutani Corporation from the original
made
film.
Made up to be 90 euros. There's a little. I remember this was a fun bit of marketing for the film. Is I think the reason they cast Guy Pearce instead of an actual octogenarian actor is that they did one of the marketing they did was like a fake TED talk from the future.
Yes,
he was this like mega. Sort of, he's like Elon Musk times 1,000, and he did a TED talk in like a stadium, and it was like a stadium of the future, and he was talking about the future, and and obviously it was just normal Guy Pearce, and they aged him for the film. So I mean, for the sake of that one marketing play to have him be an old person, I mean, yeah, a lot of people had a problem with old Guy Pearce instead of just a normal old actor. I can't say it distracts me too much, but I do think it's a bit, because he's just doing a kind of creaky old person performance, and it's a little bit just, it's a bit strange.
I mean, it's a whole load of nothing, isn't it? He's on the screen for about 2 minutes, and he doesn't really stink up the room particularly. The thing that stinks up the room is more the CG, which at that point in time wasn't as good as it is now for aging. I don't know whether it's CG or whether it was makeup or a combination of the two, but the aging doesn't look as good, right? Whereas if you watch the most recent times they've done that stuff in, for example, I don't know if you saw Aquaman, but at the beginning of Aquaman, Nicole Kidman is made to be young, and it's freaky how good that is. And then they've done the same thing, I think, in Endgame. Doesn't Michael Douglas turn up and he looks young?
He does in one of the Ant-Man.
In one of the Ant-Man.
Samuel L. Jackson and Captain Marvel.
That's a better example. They did a really good job of that because he's in like the whole movie. So the technology's a lot better now than it was back then, which is fair enough. And people have to, you have to have these guys trying and getting it shit, like Attack of the Clones, until we kind of get the technology we have now.
Easier to de-age someone than it is to age them. Although maybe not. I don't know. I used FaceApp the other day and did the old
thing. Yeah.
Like, that's probably how I'll look when in like 30 yeah. years time, 30, 40 years time. Yeah, no, it's not good. Like, it's, I think it's just, the makeup is just too much. Like, it's, well, he's in his 90s, so give him lots and lots of wrinkles.
It is too
wrinkles.
Much, yeah. It
give
is.
Him lots of bald spots, and it's like, just too much old man, you know? It's, yeah, it doesn't really hold together.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't look great, but it's not distractingly bad for me anyway. Like, that scene doesn't really bother me. I did notice, because I've now started noticing this thing because I have a dog, that he has a very nice dog. I like
he does.
Dog.
I noticed that this time as well. I was like, that's a nice touch.
That's
like,
a nice
he's got
dog.
His dog with him.
Yeah, and the dog's just, like, rolling around on its back on the floor, like, wanting belly rubs that it's not getting from this old 90-year-old tosser, but whatever. I felt sorry for the dog.
Yeah, I'll always give a half point to any sci-fi or action film that can include a dog in some kind of interesting way. Independence Day so far is top of the rank of sci-fi dogs.
Mild spoilers for Jason Statham film The Meg, but I watched that the other day, and I've now become that person who cheers when the dog survives. Because I never used to, like, normally, like, an Independence Day, when the dog survives, I'm like, oh, come on. Are people that simple-minded that they need, in the middle of all this carnage, for just the dog to survive? Is that enough, people? And then there's this bit in The Meg where this little dog is trying to swim away from the shark, and it cuts away just as the shark's about to eat the dog. And, and me and Jen were really like, my wife, we're really like, oh no, oh god, did he eat the dog? And then at the end of the film, when the dog's alive, I was like, yeah! So I have become person now.
I rate that as well. Volcano, Tommy Lee Jones's Volcano, another great example.
Dante's Peak has one as well.
Does it? Oh, it does, of course it does. Yeah.
Dante's Peak has one. They have to save that off the volcano.
Good work, 90s.
This is such a staple. But anyway, there's a dog here. I'm disappointed it doesn't have much...
Speaking lines. It doesn't have more of a role.
It should have been... It's the future, so it should have not been Gopis's pet. It should have been his, like, science advisor or something.
Yeah.
Take it away, Scruffums. And he's like, thank you, sir.
I would give anything for, like, a mega budget movie with such serious Nolan-esque intentions to take such a left turn and have a talking dog.
I think if that had happened in this movie, that people would be talking about that rather than Jar Jar Binks. You know, that would be like the go-to thing that people hate about a sci-fi movie. Anyway, so he's got a good dog. He talks about how David's like a son to him. Cut to Charlize Theron looking a bit narked about it. He talks about how Noomi Rapace and fake Tom Hardy are basically in charge of this whole mission, which Charlize Theron looks really narked about. He talks about how David's going to live forever, but unfortunately for him, he doesn't have a soul. Sucks to be you, David. And then David looks a bit sad about it. So we get a lot of these little dynamics about what might be sort of motivating people and how they might feel about each other. I think just to kind of jump forward at light speed from this scene, you get the next scene, which is where the 20 minutes actually occurs. You get the scene where Charlize Theron's character kind of waves her dick around in Noomi Rapace and Fate Tom Hardy's faces and tells them that she's in charge, actually, and they don't need to know what's going on this mission. Actually, they should kind of just do what they're told. And I think that what's really kind of good about this first 20 minutes from that character point of view, even if these things aren't particularly in depth, is that, as I say, we get the archetypes of the kind of tertiary or secondary characters established. They're just archetypes. Idris Elba's character is not really a character. He's kind of just like cool pilot guy, and that's fine.
The breezy
but,
captain.
Exactly. Whereas the relationships established between David, Charlize Theron, Captain Theron, Noomi Rapace, and fake Tom Hardy, we kind of have an idea of how they relate to each other after the first 20 minutes, what the kind of conflicts in play are, how they're kind of going to rub against each other over the rest of the movie. And I think that's all fairly well established, actually.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I guess it was nice and neat that the 20 minute mark, it falls on the line. So they explain about why they're there, and they say they've seen these cave paintings, which all have the same star system in them, which is why they've come there, and they believe that's where life originated from. And, you know, sort of the Rafe Spall starts throwing, yeah, but Darwinism, what about that? I didn't think of that, blah, blah, blah. And then Numi Rapace is like, you know, we call them engineers and they engineered us. And that's like the mark is like, and you get, and right away you're like, okay, this is what they've been doing for the whole 20 minutes. They've been they've been trying to figure out, you know, the origins of life on Earth and whether we had a sort of helping hand.
Is that where 20 minutes was for you?
I think so, yeah.
I don't know whether
much.
I'm watching, because I was watching it on, I live in Spain, the cable provider I have is called Movistar. They're like the equivalent of, I don't know, whoever, HBO or whatever here. And I was watching it streamed off there, and I don't know whether they've got a truncated version or you were watching an extended version, but my 20 minutes...
there is a director's cut out there, okay. So maybe...
Because my 20 minutes landed in the middle of the scene with Charlize Theron swinging her dick around with them all. Afterwards.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Like,
yeah,
I think
wow.
the exact moment my 20 minutes kicked in was when Numi Rapace is looking at that medical pod thing and going, oh, wow, you've got what, these neat medical pod things.
Oh,
thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So mine was a lot earlier than that.
Oh, wow.
Interesting.
Oh, I wonder
so we have
what
our
extra.
First on 20 minutes in.
Yeah.
Different 20 minutes in.
Well, my 20 minutes, which I'm going to assume is the bare bollocks theatrical cut compared to whatever. Did you watch it off a Blu-ray?
I watched it online.
Okay,
through,
so you probably
sources.
So you might have ended up with a sort of Blu-ray cut with extra scenes thrown in or a slightly extended length potentially.
Yeah,
right.
I just want to check now because I'm curious because I'm in front of there. But yeah, go ahead.
So basically, assuming mine's the theatrical cut, it might not be. But just for a second, until you find out otherwise, I'm going to suggest it is. My 20 minutes ends when you've had the characters and their relationships kind of established. You get Sharon, kind of Theron rather, throwing around saying that she's actually in charge here. You get introduced to two things I'm fairly sure come back later as kind of plot devices. The fact that she's got this thing they call the lifeboat, which is her own kind of fully independent bit in the middle of the ship, which is like a security measure, and the fact that she's got this medical pod, which I remember does end up being kind of crucial later in the film. So you get a lot of stuff established after 20 minutes. I don't think all of it's done super great. Like you're saying, some of the lines are a bit chunky with the kind of secondary crew members, and some of the characterizations are kind of overly broad. And personally, I don't love the theme of I mean, this is just me not liking the film rather than the film being bad, but personally I don't love the kind of thing of the scientist character who's taken all these people off for a few years into the middle of outer space because of belief. That doesn't make any fucking sense to me whatsoever. You don't say to this room of scientists on this expedition, so why do you think this thing's here? Because I believe it. Like, no, say, right. Well, we're looking at the evidence, so we're going to check it out. You know, well, we looked at these things, they seem to point in this direction, we're going to go down and see if they're here. Don't worry, biologist guy. Don't worry about darling biologist guy, because we're going to check it out tomorrow. We're here now. Let's have a look.
This is where the film really starts to fall apart later, in just because it becomes this. It seems to me that they had that there was a kind of writer's room and they brainstormed a lot of these clever ideas. They were like, it's about the origins of man and who created man, and we create life. So what does that mean? We've created a robot. What
exactly,
does that mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, oh, so we have a character, our central character, and she's in a relationship, but you find out later that she's barren. She can't create life. What does that mean? She also believes in God, but she's trying to uncover the science of things. And look, they found this planet, but they can't really figure out what it has to do with creating life. And then, but there's aliens on it. There's a cobra and he kills people. And then, you know, she gets pregnant, even though she's barren, with an alien being. But they kill it off. Don't worry about that. And then later in the film, something that kind of resembles an alien shows up. And then there's more conversations. And budget Tom Hardy is constantly disappointed that he's not immediately found the scientific explanation he came out there to see. And that's, I mean, that's really where it just, you know, none of those things tie together. Individually, there's so much promise in those ideas. But nothing, they never found like a proper through line. I think really the optimum kind of And I don't know if you have any, I mean, it's always a fun conversation to have where we theorize a better way of doing this kind of thing. And maybe we can get into that later. But it feels like it should have been like the setup essentially the same, is that they've found these things on Earth that indicate something else out there. And as scientists, they're desperate to uncover the meaning of that creation. And there's no sort of spiritual kind of underpinnings to it necessarily, whether or not there is some discussion of that later to bolster that thematic, you know, kind of workings. That could be added, but really it's kind of would work better without this bulky thematic stuff, you know, underpinned by some weak characterization, some archetype, you know. Like, there is a good movie here, I think. There is a really good idea for a movie.
It's interesting you kind of mention a lot of the themes that are in place, because I've actually written down that a lot of those are established in this first 20 minutes. The kind of the idea of belief and faith, the idea, can people play God, you know, what is God? Can we meet God, you know? Religion and science, can they be fused together in the way that the new Rapace character seems to be both? And I think the thing with a lot of those themes is that they kind of write themselves into a corner, because a lot of those above the pay grade of the film, and a lot of those things, some of them can't be answered. You know what I mean? Yeah. So they're kind of, if you're going to tackle them, you either have to do it in a really not necessarily abstract's the right word, but explore them with metaphor and symbolism and a kind of discussion around the points, rather than actually try and find answers. And this just has lots of people talking at each other. This kind of does what the Wachowski Matrix films ended up doing, which is just having people say Darwin at each other, and we're supposed to go, this is so smart. So what a smart film I'm watching.
They read Darwin, wow.
I don't know. I feel like they write themselves into a corner a bit, because they're things that the film can't really resolve. I think the whole idea that they're looking for an alien being that potentially seeded life. So does that mean the alien is their God? What does that mean for faith? I mean, is that thing still God, or do we still have God other than the alien thing? Yeah. And are we God in the same way, because we've created the robot? That's all kind of interesting, but I think that could be interesting off in the margins as things to kind of ruminate on, much like in the same way in the original Alien movie, or in the kind of all of the Sigourney Weaver ones. For most of those movies, the idea that they're about motherhood is really a kind of film studies course background thing, right? That you kind of see the theme of it going on. Yeah. It's not something that comes up in big capital letters in the movie. Obviously, James Cameron in Aliens, he has that, is she called Newt?
He has
the Newt character, who then is kind of a surrogate daughter that Ripley's got to sort of look after. And then the really bad, is it the fourth one, Resurrection? That goes really far the other way with it, where it becomes surface level, doesn't it? And Sigourney Weaver starts talking about the aliens being her babies and all this kind of thing.
Well, she has in the fourth one, she's like kind of cloned, but some of the alien DNA is built in, so she has this symbiotic thing.
So they kind of do end up in some of them taking it more to the surface than in other ones. But like in the original movie, themes around motherhood are basically a film studies essay, kind of look into the kind of the background and the kind of ideas underpinning the film. They aren't the film. You know, you can watch Alien and see it simply as a really good film about a monster on a ship and who's going to get away from the monster on the ship, right?
Right. Yeah.
Whereas Prometheus only wants to bore you with its things about God
this
and belief.
This is kind of what I meant about, like, they sat and they brainstormed all these things and decided what they wanted it to be about, but they didn't edit any of them out. Like, really, what this film needs to be is, we discovered these patterns in a cave and we've all gone out to figure out what it means. Oh, but we found out they're actually engineering dangerous life forms, and that's where you get the origins of Alien, you know? Mm. Like, because it kind of has this weak, oh, we're not alien, but then we're going to throw in an alien right at the end just to kind of fuck with you. You know, it really should have just been, effectively a kind of adventure film in space that turns into that kind of sci-fi horror hybrid that the original Alien had. And yeah, it kind of just gets so bogged down in that meta-textual, like you say, films. It does become a film studies essay on itself, which is just really, really flabby and really kind of like hard work.
I just think like when they were writing this movie, they were high on the fact that the original Alien movies, at least the first two, were highly regarded for this kind of subtext aspect. And it went, it tried to turn that subtext stuff into the text, and it doesn't really work, and it kind of distracts from the movie. Whereas if they just made a really entertaining horror sci-fi movie like the original films, and then in the background you had this idea of, you know, well, wait a second, Noomi Price's character's wearing a cross, so clearly she believes in a god, but also she's trying to find out who this alien is who created mankind, so she thinks that this alien created mankind, but she believes in God. That's interesting. Michael Fassbender's character's a robot. He's clearly being created by us, so are we God? Those things would all still be there if none of the characters ever explicitly mentioned them, and then they would become a much richer subtext, right? And you could discuss it and think about it and say, oh, that's quite clever, or do you know the film's actually got these elements underpinning it? That's interesting.
And it but it becomes rewatches in the way that it doesn't right now.
Whereas actually, like I say, like Matrix Reloaded or whatever, it just, it ends up with characters just sort of saying these things at each other. Oh, it's because I follow belief, and oh, what about Charles Darwin and evolution? And and you know, hey lady, this is ridiculous, I don't believe in nothing, I'm a nihilist, you know. And then like Weyland Yutani man going like, oh, he doesn't have a soul, you know. You know, it's all just on the surface right there.
Sleep.
And it doesn't really need to be. I think the film would be stronger without that, if they just kind of like you say, just made a straight
well, this I think the thing about the first 20 minutes that really strikes me is that I kind of watched it again pretending I didn't know anything about Prometheus and where it goes and all the problems that it has. And the sort of the, what's going on in the first 2 minutes, the approach at least, is that it's not just going to be your straight up sci-fi horror. We're not going to trade off of the kind of Alien franchise, at least initially. It's gonna have a sense of like discovery. It's going to be a space discovery movie, kind of. And I know I keep saying this, but really the score does a lot of, to flag this up, is the kind of Star Trek thing, is that Star Trek episodes, at least the early ones, were all about we're in space and we're exploring and we find these civilizations, and then ethical questions get thrown up, you know, sort of philosophical ideas get explored in the confines of a kind of pretty on the nose, not on the nose, what am I trying to say, pretty just like tight narrative effectively. And there is, you know, in those kind of, there's a really only kind of 4 or 5 scenes in those first 20 minutes that start to give that sense that it's going to explore those things. You know, you have like scientists exploring a cave and finding an ancient civilization. You have like this being come down by itself and drink this thing. And, you know, then you see the water and you see life start to be created. And that sort of sets up a question. And then you have a robot wandering around by himself on a ship, which just alone, that image is really kind of fantastic and really gripping, is that he's just on his own, just doing this thing. And what do robots do if they're left by themselves? And how do they nourish their kind of sense of living? You know, they just sort of watch films, dye their hair and play basketball, you know. So there are all these kind of elements. It's when it started, really it was when they all start waking up, and I thought, I was thinking this earlier when you were talking about those kind of archetype characters, is in the first Alien, where, that when they all wake up is they have that scene where they're all sitting around eating breakfast, and there's just one or two lines that are given to the characters who I'm pretty sure die first in Alien. Like, you don't really see a lot of Sigourney Weaver. You sort of see they're all there. There's a captain. And then the conversation is just the two engineers, and they start talking about, like, contracts and, you know, bureaucracy and not getting paid enough. And that just is enough to tell you, you know, that's not like, it's not like Harry Dean Stanton and Yaphet Kotto just wake up in the first Alien and go, look, we're just here to make money, so can you just all fuck off and do your jobs, please? Like, they don't lean on that. It's like, they, you know, them talking about bonuses while they're in space just tells you so much about the relationships between the characters and the tone of like character interplay in that whole film, which just doesn't really happen. I think for me, it's when you have Rafe Spall and Sean Harris, because later on that whole subplot becomes so fucking stupid. Like they're trapped in the cave. And they discover like an headless alien, and they both just like run away. They're just like, dead body, even though they're scientists, you know. And then they get trapped, and then Rafe Spall sees the space cobra, and instead of being like immediately wary of this extraterrestrial being, he's just like, oh, come here, little buddy, come here, what are you? Which obviously kills him. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's just, it's really disappointing that something that had a sense of like it was going to stand on its own and had really good ideas on how it was going to do that just gets so over bloated and bogged down and like misguided. It's a shame.
Yeah, it is. It is. I think there's a missed opportunity with Prometheus for sure. And I wonder what the original plan was for it, because it was supposed to start its own franchise, right? And then when they did make Alien Covenant, only does the alien name come back, but the Noomi Rapace characters died between films. The only thing that's really a reference from the first film, Michael Fassbender, and they also begin the film, I think, with another big CGI massive white alien sequence, don't they?
Yeah.
I think like a big group of massive white aliens gets killed by another group of aliens. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's some huge, massive scene takes place at the beginning with like all these alien dudes. But so it's clearly still continuing the Prometheus mythos, but it's, I wonder what the original plan was to run with that rather than what they eventually did do. Because it seems like what they eventually did do was run hard back to the alien franchise, but try to pretend they still were keeping the Prometheus thing alive.
Yeah, but I mean, to anyone with like, you know, eyes and a brain, it's just like, yeah, you've chickened out is what you've done. I mean, do you have any thoughts on if Prometheus lands in your hands, how you would like correct course?
I think what we were saying before about how you want to go back to what made it. I think when Right, rewind. We were talking about at the start about going to see this on midnight launch, right?
Yeah.
And you were saying about how at the time it was exciting. The reason it had a midnight launch was because Ridley Scott had returned to Alien for the first time since the original film in the 70s. And this was a chance to make a proper one again, basically, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so with that in mind, I think what people wanted was a movie that was going to be not similar to the original Alien, like we were just sitting around waiting for it to remake Alien, but another film that was going to just stand apart and be a really polished sort of sci-fi horror movie in that same vein, kind of in the way that Alien is sort of, because that's something this movie doesn't really do either. You know, the way Alien had this kind of retro sci-fi aesthetic, which this movie just ditches, even though it's set before, which, you know, I understand Alien looks the way it did because it came out at that time, but that's kind of really iconic to the series as well, and this kind of doesn't redo that. But you already don't have that same kind of vibe that he brought, which had that kind of really gritty aspect to it, and made the people seem more vulnerable as well, because they're in this kind of, to our sensibilities, quite old-fashioned looking spaceship. You know, it's quite chunky and it's full of like phones and really antiquated technology. Exactly. So I think that could have added something to it, because I think that would have given that amount of kind of vulnerability to it, that amount of them sort of being in an egg carton in space type aspect. But also I think if he'd run harder into just the horror, I think you shouldn't really start it with, as well done as it is, you shouldn't really start it with the big alien dude falling in the water, because what the film's trying too hard to do is explain things in the deep lore of Alien, right? Trying to explain things that are gone. And these things are more interesting when they're not explained. Like, I don't just mean like not explored at all or not discussed at all. You can have some of that in the movie. But I don't think they should. I think there's more horror in it being less knowable. I think if they turn up on the planet and start to piece this thing together, and there's almost a kind of Lovecraftian horror going on there of like, oh, what the hell have we uncovered? What is this? Oh, this relates to Earth. Are these the people that birthed us? Oh my God, yeah. We're being attacked by aliens. That could have been more horrific. And yeah. I think all of the other themes could have been something going on underpinning that to give it some more heft and some more subtext.
Yeah.
And I think in the end we do get a Matrix sequel just over-explaining itself, thinking it's probably a bit cleverer than it is.
Yeah.
And so I don't really specifically have notes on, you know, what they should have done.
What you're talking about, and I don't mean this facetiously, is effectively the Blair Witch Project in space, which would have been a fantastic... Because, you know, the whole thing with the Blair Witch is it kind of plays as a... It could be an amazing... horror prequel to a kind of horror sort of staple that doesn't even exist. Like the whole way through the Blair Witch Project, the very beginning, they meet sort of people and they're asking, you know, they're making the fake documentary and they're talking to these people asking about the legend and they give conflicting accounts of sightings and all this. And then throughout the film, it, you know, it's, you obviously you never see anything, but there are hints to that and, you know, characters running around terrified. And I suppose talking exclusively about just mythology and world building within a film, that film does an incredible job of hinting at all these things, but focusing solely on these three characters and what they're going through and using those elements to kind of, I don't know, build like a whole picture of this legend. And obviously it's not kind of the idea of an alien or kind of a culture of aliens who build life in space is not kind of, you know, it's very different. But to that similar approach would have been really fantastic. Because again, with the first Alien, it's like they just get a signal when they're on their way back and then they land on it. And these incredible HR Giga designs, which are so alien and perhaps the most alien designs that have ever been put on film... you know, purely that they are just so beyond anything really humans would build and can conceive. You know, there's so much about that that's really chilling. You know, they go into these things that are so different from anything on Earth, that look like anything on Earth. I think, yeah, that's really what you need to kind of tap the sort of sci-fi horror vein properly. Is this sense of not knowing what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, and I think they had an opportunity to do that all over again, because I think if they hadn't run into having so many nods to the original Alien and having had that little creature that basically looks like the Xenomorph near the end of the film, they could have really defined a new creepy as hell, unknowable, unimaginable horror, couldn't they,
to kind of
freak people out with. And I think that they then, with Covenant, which obviously is not what we're talking about, but with Covenant they then run into Aliens territory, and Aliens is a fun film, but it's not really similar film to Alien. They run into Aliens territory and suddenly just have loads and loads of Xenomorphs running at people and guns and all that, which is not... It's so out of step with what Prometheus thinks it is that it's just baffling that they're even related in any way. So it's a failed experiment and a weird curiosity, I think, as a film.
But definitely.
I think based on what you originally said about why we should do this one, that it's an example of a fairly promising opening 20. I think it is a fairly promising opening 20. I don't love the first opening 20 minutes, but it did make me intrigued to watch the film again, even though I know I don't like the film that much. And I think there are a lot of compelling things in it. And I think the as much as I miss kind of the retro futurism stuff, it does have really good design. It does have, like you say, the score, the whole atmosphere of it is kind of pulls you in and is compelling. So, this could have ended up being a really good movie, and the cast is really good. I mean, all of the weird accents aside, like it's a good cast. I don't know who budget Tom Hardy is, but presumably Tom Hardy wasn't available.
I think he's probably too surly for this type of thing. Although he would have reveled in weird accent territory.
That was the first.
Ridley had approached him like, "I want you to play. You're just a fairly kind of." Down the line scientist, and you're just in a happy relationship with Neuropass, and he was like, can I do a Jamaican accent?
Yeah.
And Ridley would have been like, yeah, sure, go for it. And then it would have been like, I'm on board.
Yeah, I think that was the first clue to me that it wasn't Tom Hardy, is because I looked at him first. I was like, is that Tom Hardy? And then when he spoke, he wasn't doing a weird voice. I immediately discounted it as
you could place him quite
as a
easily.
Possibility. Yeah. Mm. Okay. So well, I think we've Prometheus. We've talked about it. It's done. It's done. So have we got any plans for what we're doing next time? We haven't discussed this offline yet, so I'm just doing the slightly awkward asking you now thing, seeing what comes to mind.
Well, I was thinking just before, have we actually done a Stanley Kubrick film?
And this is so wild. This is so wild because you know how earlier you said budget Tom Hardy and it was in my notes, budget Tom Hardy? I was literally about to say to you, have we done a Stanley Kubrick film yet?
That's creepy. That's
really creepy, isn't it?
Melding of minds.
I see. Both of our favourite is Barry Lyndon, right? Yours is Barry Lyndon as well.
Barry
right?
Lyndon. I wouldn't. Barry Lyndon's definitely my top three.
Okay.
I think my top one will always be 2001.
Okay.
But Barry Lyndon is a very strong. I mean, it's definitely in top three. Potentially like second down because it's such an underrated.
Because I was going to say
that would be a great choice. Actually,
it would. And I love the opening of that film. I love the opening of pretty much all of Kubrick's movies. But like. What I was going to suggest was maybe it's better to do a more iconic movie than Barry Lyndon if we're doing Kubrick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like maybe 2001 is the clearer choice. And
well,
I think 2001's interesting as well because the opening 20 minutes does lots of strange things. And like the opening 5 minutes is just pitch black screen. So that's
a challenge. Good.
That's a challenge right there.
Yeah. That would be really interesting. I'm kind of tempted. I mean, you know, discussions we can go into, but I'm kind of tempted Barry Lyndon just because it's a bit of an underdog and I don't think it gets the attention it deserves. And I think there's a lot we could do for that film in terms of assessing it and taking it apart.
All right,
we'll
then.
See. I mean, I'm up for both, to be honest.
I would say we'll do a listener poll, but I don't want to open us up for the... the lack of response that we got.
I think the fans,
the screaming fans,
would probably scream for blood if we didn't do 2001. So maybe that is.
Well, if you are one of the fans, one of the faithful, one of the I don't know what the term should be for fans of the 20 minutes.
The Minutemen.
If you're one of the brave Minutemen or women listening to this podcast. One of the 20-minute men. You should let us know. Is it Barry Lyndon or 2001: A Space Odyssey? We'll do one or the other next time. Thanks for sticking with us. In the meantime, I'm Robert Beams and
I'm Tom Oliver.
Thanks for listening.
Goodbye.
Bye.